Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, we like to tell the story of many groups that at times in America have been very much dispossessed. They really have had to live in the shadows and never really had the comfort of being who they want to be. And I saw this book, The Deviance War, The Homosexual Versus the United States of America by Eric Cervini. And I thought it was really fascinating because we know civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King and many others. But when it comes to gay rights, we think of Stonewall many years ago and that whole movement. But we don't really tie a particular individual to the struggle. We even know, what was the woman's name? O'Hare, who was the, for atheist rights. Madeline Marie O'Hare. I saw an interesting movie on her. So even atheist rights, we know there's a name attached, but very little is to a leader who really took the plunge and really took on, in this case, the U.S. federal government for gay rights because he worked for the government. This gentleman, Franklin Kameny, who really set in motion a lot of changes.
Yeah, I've never heard this story, so I'm anxious to hear the podcast. This is very interesting how one guy can stand up to the government for
gay rights. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, most people do go back to 1969 Stonewall riots that they think gave birth to the militant gay politics. But for almost a decade, John, before Stonewall,
Frank Kameny
boldly challenged the reigning orthodoxy that homosexuality was a mental illness and led a really bold campaign against the federal government's ban on employing gay workers. Because, of course, John, gay workers, I'm sure, were replete in the workforce, but they had to hide who they were.
Well, right, exactly. I think there's for years that they were working and nobody knew.
And this man evidently was a brilliant scientist. So we're going to be talking about his story and then leading into where the gay rights movement is today. Eric Cervini is with us, the author of this book, and he's a young historian of LGBTQ politics and really has done an exhaustive search to find who this man was and to really bring his story forward in these times. When you've got to say this, John, it's pretty amazing to me how quickly gay marriage went from something that was almost unthinkable in our culture to something that's now widely accepted. It's pretty remarkable. Well, that wasn't the story for the gentleman we're going to be first talking about as a launching point to have this conversation about the Deviance War today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Eric Cervini, and he's written a book called The Deviance War, The Homosexual Versus the United States of America. And it's a fascinating look at one gentleman to whom many have not been really aware, I think, over the years, Eric. And you purposely wanted to make certain that his importance in the movement had not been left out of the story. Many people do attribute the movement to the riots of Stonewall in 1969. But this gentleman, Frank Kameny, his story goes back much further than that.
That's right, and thank you so much for having me. I discovered Frank's name about 7 years ago and have been working on telling his story since then, and I was really shocked the first time I heard his name back in 2013 that historians have long regarded him as the grandfather of the gay rights movement, but I certainly, as you know, a young college student, had never heard his name, and I think most Americans probably have not either, despite his foundational role in the creation of what we now celebrate each and every June as Pride.
And you think about it, I mean, what he went through and how bold and brave he was at a time when it was really difficult for people to acknowledge their own sexuality, to come out, to come forward, and then to challenge this amongst, you know, all of the issues involved and government and putting his entire career on the line.
Exactly. And he, you know, I always like to introduce him as, first and foremost, an astronomer. He grew up in the 30s and in Queens and New York, wanting to do nothing else other than studying the stars. And he got his PhD from Harvard in astronomy in 1956, the year before the launch of Sputnik. So you quite literally could not have picked a better time to have been an astronomer than at the launch of the space race. And as America was creating the American space program, NASA wouldn't be formed for two more years. And unfortunately, the government found out that he was gay, and he became one of countless thousands who was purged from their government jobs simply for that fact. And unlike the vast majority of federal employees who were victims of the gay purges, Frank Kameny fought back. He was the first to take his case to the Supreme Court to argue his case in Congress as part of testimony to picket outside the White House. Part of the reason why people didn't demonstrate, they didn't fight back, was because if you had a Washington Post article about your Supreme Court case or about your demonstration, and not just the federal government, but any employer, a private employer, or your family found out that you were a sexual deviant, as they were called, then you were marked for the rest of your life. And Kameny, as you mentioned, he sacrificed so much because he voluntarily placed himself in a second-class citizenship that so many Americans found themselves in involuntarily.
If we're looking for parallels with other civil rights movements, you've got to help us to understand how different it was, because if you were black, anybody knew you were black. If you're a woman, people know you're a woman. But there were so many people not willing to take up the fight, come out of the closet. How difficult and more courageous does it make it for someone like him to lead this effort at that moment in time in America, when the science actually was suggesting psychologically that there was something different about the person who was a deviant, as you say?
Right. Well, it's an interesting and complex problem, because on one hand, as you mentioned, Frank Kameny not only had to fight the government, but he also had to persuade other sexually deviant Americans, or queer Americans, as we would call them today, that they were part of a minority group, that they actually had rights worth fighting for, that they weren't simply mentally ill. That was a big part of his fight, was persuading others that within the gay minority, that in fact they were part of a minority and that they weren't sick and that they actually deserved to be fighting together. But on the other hand, to be gay, especially compared to other movements or other identities, Frank Kameny also had a lot of privilege in that he could choose if he wanted to pass. He was, you know, if you saw him on the street, you would never guess that he was a homosexual. And so that got him in the door in many places. It allowed him to access the job in the first place, right? It allowed him to access the meeting rooms where he was able to lobby congressmen and bureaucrats and administration officials that homosexuals were a valid minority to begin with. And because he was, you know, he was a white guy, he wasn't entirely impoverished from his upbringing. You know, that also was a part of his identity that helped him and really allowed him to make that argument to others that to be gay was actually part of one's identity.
Yet at the end of Kameny's ordeal, he was jobless, barely eating or paying his rent. He did pay a price.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why it's so important to recognize that he could have, if he wanted to, followed the path of so many others who found themselves the victims of prejudice and the gay purges and just move on with their life. He could have moved out of Washington, D.C. after getting fired, maybe gotten a job in academia. He could have gotten a job in private industry. But he chose to remain exactly where he was. He had spent 20 years training to become an astronomer, and an astronomer he decided he would be, no matter what. And although he died in 2011 at the age of 86 and was never allowed to work as an astronomer, and I think that's the great tragedy of his life, because he stood by his principles, and he continued fighting and allowed himself to live in poverty for his entire life, despite so many of his privileges. I think that really is the true sacrifice he made.
I did a podcast just about a year back about how the Zionist movement among young people back in the day was inspired by black activism. I believe that Kameny, and you point this out, he advocated a more militant approach in many ways than I think most people at the time would have, and he was inspired by the direct action tactics of the black civil rights movement. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And I'll be the first to admit I had no idea that that was what I was going to find when I was studying his activism, his tactics, and his ideologies. One of the first jobs of a historian is to ask why. Why? Where did this come from? Why did he decide to march? Why did he decide to declare that gay is good in 1968, a whole year before Stonewall? And what you realize is every step of the way, and this is true for really the entirety of the gay rights and queer liberation movement, that they were looking, including Frank Kameny, first and foremost, he was the first to look to the black freedom movement and adopt consciously the tactics and ideologies of activists ranging from going all the way back to Rosa Parks, right, in 1955 and 1956, as King and influenced by another gay black man, Byron Rustin, embracing the tactics of nonviolent direct action. Frank Kameny saw that same phenomenon and said, you know what, well, I'm going to prove that the federal government is the one that is immoral. The gay minority is not immoral, just as Rosa Parks, just like the students at Greensboro and other activists who were instructed, you know, dress as if you were going to church because they were projecting what is called the politics of respectability. So Frank Kameny borrowed that from the Black Freedom Movement, and that's why in his Supreme Court brief in 1961, he declares that homosexual activity is actually a moral good, because he's just copying the same strategy of the Black Freedom Movement in proving that the immoral, the ones who were actually acting with injustice, was the white racist segregationists in the South. And Frank Kameny used that same strategy to flip the argument, show that the immoral one was actually the federal government.
One of the difficult things I would imagine politically in organizing, as we talked about, that many of those who would be very sympathetic or themselves are queer, as you say, they didn't want to come out. And there's always been that question about the percentage of the population that is, gay or lesbian. And we've never really totally resolved that, I guess. In your book, you talked about the fact that there was this research done by Loud Humphrey. There was research by Alfred Kinsey. Have we really come to a point where we actually have that number? And how important is that number in terms of a political power force, knowing that, it's 10 or 13%, that's different than 2%.
Right. And it depends what number you want. I mean, Frank Kameny always, he kind of used his own distillation of Kinsey to claim that the number was 10%. And recent studies have found different numbers. But as you said, you know, the point is, regardless of what the number, whether it's 2% or 10%, that's a huge number of Americans. Of citizens, of people who have political power. And that was a big part of what Frank Kameny was trying to do, was to not only persuade the government and persuade elected officials that if you discriminate against people who are homosexual or truly deviant, then you will feel the political ramifications. And that concept simply didn't exist, partially because people who were gay, or at the time who engaged in homosexual behavior, because even the word gay was still emerging as a commonly used term at the time. He had to convince them that they also had political power. So it was a very difficult struggle. It was a two-front battle that you see throughout the book. But by then, certainly he ends up running for Congress in 1971. And part of the reason why he does that is to prove to the government, to prove to elected officials, you know, anyone who voted for him was likely gay and represented a gay voting bloc. And so if you wanted to win, and if you were a mainstream politician, then you had to also win over the gay minority. And you see that immediately after 1971, the straight political structure in Washington, D.C. immediately begins taking Frank Kameny and the gay minority seriously, because they see the numbers. They see how many thousands of people supported Frank Kameny.
Even though his importance has been underestimated, how important was Stonewall in 1969? And if you want to put it in perspective for us as to other, either riots or marches or things that have defined other civil rights movements, put it into some context.
Sure. It's a great question, because it's absolutely essential part of our history. And I don't want anyone to think that I'm minimizing the value of that moment. And I always love to say Stonewall wasn't the event that started everything, but it was the event that changed everything. And a really good comparison, and I'm glad you asked that, I think, is quite frankly the protest that you're seeing this year, sparked by George Floyd and the murder of George Floyd, and the rise in dialogue and the explosion of a movement, of the Black Lives Matter movement just this year. And it's a really helpful analog, I think, because activists within Black Lives Matter will be the first to argue that Black Lives Matter as a movement existed long before 2020, existed long before June of this year. But this year, and the murder of George Floyd, and the protests, and the uprising, and the huge upsurge in discussion and in visibility, was also crucial in creating not just political change, but also ideological change, political change within the hearts and minds of Americans. And you see the numbers of how many people now support Black Lives Matter. The exact same phenomenon happened in 1969. Of course, there were raids and uprisings and gay bars throughout American history. What was different about Stonewall, just as today we have iPhones police are recording their activities, at Stonewall you had two Village Voice reporters who were there and who captured everything. And then the New York Times picked it up, and then the entire national media picked it up. So that was really the difference, but it sent a signal to everyone who may have been gay or may have been sexually deviant or queer, but instead of fighting within the homophile movement, as it was called, the pre-Stonewall gay rights movement that Frank Kameny was a part, they were fighting maybe against the war, or they were fighting for women's liberation, or they were fighting within the Black freedom movement. And what Stonewall did is it told these people who were already activists and fighting in other movements that finally, at last, another part of their identity was fighting for its own existence and putting their bodies on the line. And of course, it was those with the least to lose, people like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, who put their bodies on the line and really made one of the most ultimate sacrifices of their own existence and to help really explode a movement.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Eric Cervini is with us. He's written a really wonderfully detailed book, The Deviance War, The Homosexual Versus the United States of America. Let me leave it at this because I want to get into some of the current and future topics that affect this particular community. But this would be an incredible movie. I don't know if you have an option on it yet, but it really deserves that kind of attention. So I would imagine it down the line. That's a possibility. What do you say about that, Eric?
I completely agree. I'll say stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Okay. Let's leave it at that. I've got to ask you, the road to gay marriage, why did it seem improbable until it quickly turned inevitable? Explain what happened there, because I'm a straight heterosexual American, and I'm watching this, and I was pretty much amazed at how quickly things turned.
Absolutely, and I think there were so many different factors, including, it was at the end of the day, and something I end the book on, the last chapter introduces Jack Baker and Michael McConnell, who were the first in the early 1970s to fight for gay marriage in Minnesota. And so it was a long battle, but beginning in the 1990s, you start to have a coordinated legal effort to fight for gay marriage. And you see organizations like the ACLU, like Lambda Legal, Human Rights Campaign, ultimately getting involved in the marriage fight. And a big part of this battle, and I think part of the reason why it's also criticized, is because it was part of a conscious strategy, just like Frank Kameny, when he first demonstrated in front of the White House. He dictated, if you demonstrated, you had to wear a suit and tie if you were a man, and a dress and heels if you're a woman, because he wanted to prove that homosexuals were just like you. They were just like straight Americans. And the marriage movement was doing something very similar. It was saying, yes, we're gay, we're queer, but we're really just like you. And so that was effective because you see also in popular culture, whether it's Will and Grace or Modern Family, where you see gay couples that are acting really just like anyone else, just like your normal picket fence American family. And that was part of a larger political strategy of saying, we're just like you. And ultimately, that was successful. But then the flip side of that is asking, well, who was left out of that equation? Who, was left behind? Whether it was Frank Kameny in the 1960s with his dress code at the demonstrations. Well, what if you didn't identify as a man or a woman? What if you were trans? Or if you were a drag queen, you certainly weren't allowed to demonstrate at the picket. And so that's why throughout history, whether it's the 60s or in the 2000s and even today, you see so many people within our movement getting left behind. And I think it's something, especially someone like me as a gay, cisgendered, white man, I have to be the first to say, yeah, I have gay marriage and I'm very excited and proud of that, fact that that's something that I was able to see in my lifetime, but also who have we left behind? And I think especially trans women of color right now, are the ones who are seeing the most violence within our community. They're 16 times more likely to be murdered if you're a black trans woman in America, and that's just odds that no one should be having to live with. So I think I encourage people to, yes, celebrate marriage, get married, but also ask, okay, because we decided that this was the most important thing to fight for, who do we now have a moral obligation to be fighting for today?
Interesting. Are the courts or legislative bodies the better locus for expanding gay civil liberties? It seems as if the courts really have been, but express yourself on that and also talk about the recent Supreme Court ruling just made about the landmark civil rights law protecting gay and transgender workers from workplace discrimination.
Well, if you asked me 6 months ago if the courts were the best avenue for achieving queer social change, I would have said no, because the composition of the court profoundly suggests that we would not be getting many advancements. But then, of course, just a couple months ago in June, you saw the opinion written by Justice Gorsuch, who no one would have expected he would be the person to write a landmark ruling on anti-discrimination and employment. But the problem is, just as you saw with Brown versus Board, and just as you've seen so many important court decisions, the court doesn't have the power to execute, to actually enforce their rulings. And you're starting to see, you know, the trans-military ban that the Trump administration enacted is still enforced despite this ruling. And I think you're going to see massive resistance with the religious loophole, where someone can say, oh, I'm discriminated because that's part of my religious belief. And so I think we have to prepare, you know, and again, celebrate the decision. Of course, it's a huge advancement because at least it's a law that we now have and that we can now point to. But it also takes widespread, not just political efforts in trying to get legislatures and political officials at the local level as well to actually abide by and be on the forefront of the decision and ending discrimination, but also changing hearts and minds and proving to Americans that, you know, we are not just like you, but also we're human, you know, just because you're gay or you're black or you're a woman does not mean you're any less. And I think that's something that we have to be talking about. And that's why I'm so grateful to be having this conversation.
Well, the whole idea that perhaps the receptivity to the lifestyle is so much accepted in cosmopolitan America, but when you go out to the rural and with the strength of the evangelical movement in America, I guess I was surprised when I was reading and getting ready for our interview to look at feelings across the globe about gay rights and how America and Europe really do stand out as being in the vanguard, in the forefront. And I'm wondering if that surprises you at times when you see a lot of the reactionary politics going on in this country.
Right. And I think you're seeing changes across the entire world in terms of where the queer community is at. And of course, the fight is not over. You know, you have places all over the world, whether it's Asia or the Middle East or Africa, where if you are gay, then you are at risk of violence and death. A new book is out called The Pink Line that just came out a couple of weeks ago that I would also highly recommend for the international battle for equality by Marka Visser. It's absolutely wonderful. But it just shows that, yeah, we are lucky in many ways that we have these rights to begin with. But again, you know, injustice needs to be fought wherever it's found. And it just shows that it's far from over the battle in our country, and the battle is just getting started in other places.
Let's take it on a more personal level. Gay youth in America today, say as opposed to 30 years ago, is it still difficult for someone to come out? Is it most difficult to tell your parents? Or explain that to me. I've always been, you know, fascinated by that, wondering that, you know, if I was gay, what I would have done, how I would have approached this.
Well, a good line that I've heard is that coming out of the closet is always a varying degree of trauma. It's never an easy thing to do. And I know statistics say that the age at which it happens on average in this country is going down, which is wonderful. But even then, you know, it's the act of coming out should never have to happen in the first place, right? The assumption should never be that you're automatically straight until you have to sit down with your parents or your loved ones or your friends and tell them that in fact you're not. And so I think hopefully there will be a day where parents no longer assume that their children are straight. And yes, it is getting easier, especially in large cities and in places where you have templates and access to what it means to be gay and happy in this country. But in so much of the country and the world, people don't have that. And thankfully, we have the internet. But even then, it really takes people coming out in their communities and showing that actually I'm your niece or nephew or your cousin or your loved one, part of your family or your friend. And yes, I am queer. And you know what? Studies show if you do that and if you come out, that's the best way to change hearts and minds. So I'd encourage anyone listening, not just to come out for yourself, but come out as a political act, to do it for others within our community who may be less able to be themselves.
Eric Cervini is with us talking about his book, The Deviant War. You mentioned about popular culture, how it has now imbued the concept of being gay as being part of the package here in America and throughout the world, and that it was taken as, one of those things. And Pete Buttigieg, I really want to ask you the importance of his run for president. There were many of us very impressed by him, and yet that was certainly not the central part of his campaign by any means, but it was something that he proudly shared with the public. Explain what that might mean going forward, and whether, in fact, going forward, we might look back at his candidacy as being very important to the movement.
Sure. Well, Frank Kameny was the first to run for a federal position in 1971, and 50 years later, Pete Buttigieg was the first, of course, openly gay man on a national debate stage. So it was an absolutely historic moment. He I think, gave hope to so many people who saw themselves in him and maybe assumed that because of their identity, they would not be able to ever run for office. And I think he proved them that actually it is possible. And I'm so excited to see what he does next. I know him. He and his husband, Chasten, have books coming out that I'm very, very excited to read.
It's interesting because I have a neighbor across the street, and at one point I had a Pete sign up, and I was kind of shocked as a conservative, which he is. And then when I had to take that sign down and put another one up, and he said, "I like Pete Buttigieg." I was very surprised. So I think
right.
He crossed a lot of lines. Very
absolutely.
What about the issue of AIDS today within the gay community? I bring that up because of the pandemic and everybody hoping that we can find a vaccine. And you could talk more broadly about the pandemic, too, within the community.
Well, AIDS crisis was a horrible time, of course, for our community and also for the country. And I think it's made all the more tragic because you're seeing what could have happened if the government acted appropriately and actually funneled the right resources to finding a treatment or a cure. Of course, you know, we're on track, even as difficult as things are, we're on track to have a vaccine within months. And for the AIDS crisis, it's been decades, and we still don't have any vaccine or cure. So it just shows, you know, when an affliction, a pandemic, hits this marginalized, and it still is. It's still affecting especially, gay black men in particular, and black communities across the country. I would hope that this is eye-opening to show, how much was lost because the government didn't act in time, and how the government still isn't doing enough to fight the HIV/AIDS crisis today.
Social media, you talked about it just briefly. What is the impact on the community in terms of rallying around various causes and various future needs? For example, that Supreme Court ruling really didn't affect a lot of areas, college housing, religious employers, healthcare, free speech. I mean, a whole range of things that are still there on the docket to be discussed. But is social media really a helpful tool in all of this?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what makes activism so much more accessible today is you know, even during this pandemic, you can go to a meeting with 100 people all spread out all over the country. To organize for change. And I think we're so lucky to have that, but it also, because there's so much of it, it makes it harder to choose what to do. And so I think that's really the challenge moving forward.
What about adoption among gay parents as one of those issues going forward? I guess when Anderson Cooper recently announced that he had adopted a child, or not adopted, actually, he had fathered the child and he had a surrogate a woman. I mean, just explain to us how complicated that process is today, or is that unfolding and becoming easier to do?
I really don't know. I haven't studied the issue of adoption. I know other scholars have done a great job, especially sociologists studying different types of families and also some of the legal issues surrounding it, and especially surrogacy is a very difficult, complex issue today, but there are certainly other scholars out there who could speak to it.
Okay, well, I don't want to put you on the spot for something, and I appreciate your honesty. The issue of whether there are issues that bring together lesbians and gay men, or whether there are issues today that you're on a different track or a different path. I'm just curious about the answer to that.
Well, I think you see it in the book, how oppression brings people together and it creates community, because the government and those in power who are trying to use any sort of minority group as a scapegoat, whether it's gay men or lesbian women, or anyone who identifies as LGBTQ+, they don't see any distinction. And so I think that's when we are under attack, whether it's the purges in the Lavender Scare or today with the pandemic and the targeting of LGBTQ+ Americans by the current administration. I hope it will bring all parts of our community, which is a very diverse one, but together again.
And when you talk about the transgender community, there's been a lot around Title IX inclusion in sports. Is that a big issue that the rest of the community has really said is one of the forward issues that has to be addressed?
Absolutely. The Republican Party's war on children, on trans children in this country is absolutely reprehensible. And I think it is an attack on our entire community, and we need to be on the forefront to fight back.
And are there any other issues that you see that will be or should be in this continuing quest for more rights and more inclusion in the society?
Absolutely. I think if there's anything I hope people take away from my book, it's that we have pride and we celebrate it. The totality of gay pride in this country was borrowed from the strategies and tactics and ideologies of the Black freedom movement. And we have gay rights today because of trans women of color. So now, as we're confronting this racial reckoning in our country and you see this upsurge in activism, I believe it's our moral obligation to join that battle, because we have so many of our rights because of the Black freedom movement, and we have not done enough historically to fight for them.
There were those at the beginning of the campaign who said of this presidential race that maybe the Black community itself did not embrace Pete Buttigieg because he was gay. How do you respond to that?
I quite frankly think those arguments are actually rather problematic and verging on racist, because I think to make a claim about any minority group and their ideologies without tracking also some of other underlying factors that may be affecting their views, I think is actually really problematic. So I think it's up to the pundits and those in the media or those who are writing on that issue to say, is this really making a claim about any minority group and their views as a whole. I would urge people to not engage in that.
Eric Cervini, I want to thank you for being with us today. Really wonderful book, The Deviant War, The Homosexual Versus the United States of America. And thank you for helping us to explore the issues of the day in the community. I really appreciate that, and I think my audience will as well. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.